This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
This is The Deep Dive, indeed, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host, as usual. And my guest today, sometimes guest because I like him because he takes that nice, big, broad picture on international affairs and helps put it into context with all the parts that require, thank you, require explanation and evaluation. Stephen Groos of the South African Institute of International Affairs, often known as Jan Smutshaus on the campus at WITS, but of course is an independent research institute and has been active for many, many years on this. And Stephen does a whole range of different topics, including things like NEPAD, the new, oh golly, you're going to have to correct me on the acronym, Stephen.
New Partnership for Africa's Development.
Right, it's that E in the middle that confounds me. I never figure out what it means. Anyway, welcome and thank you very much for joining us again. And this is a fascinating week if you're an international affairs analyst, specialist, or just an observer. And let's start, if we might, with South Africa's hosting of the G20, which is now actually not the G20 anymore. It's depending on who you count, who's coming, and those others, it's a different number. But what is the purpose of the G20, and why is South Africa hosting it, and what is it that South Africa seems to want to expect will be gained by this process?
Well, good morning, Brooks, and thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to chat to you, and I love the format of the deep dive, which allows us to dive deeply, I guess. So the G20 stands for the Group of 20. It was first established in 1999 as a way for both the G7 economies, and they were probably maybe even the G8 by then, because Russia was probably in the club and hadn't been kicked out as it was in 2014. But the established Western economies plus Russia, as well as the BRICS, which were just emerging at that stage. And it was the finance ministers and the central bank governors of the 20 most significant economies, not necessarily the biggest. So, for example, Spain does not have a seat at the G20, about which it's quite upset, but it does get invited to the summits on a regular basis. I think it's a permanent invitee. Anyway, this was not a heads of state meeting. It was a meeting at the level of central bank governors and finance ministers or finance secretaries, depending on the country. And they were getting together to try and stabilize the world's economy after shocks. So you had the Asian crisis, you had the financial crisis, the various financial crises, particularly the one at the end of 2008 into 2009, when Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns and the subprime crisis was triggered a huge economic downturn. This was in the very early days of the Obama presidency. In fact, I think in 2008, he may have been the president-elect and not yet the president. So it got caught up in the campaign of 2008, and they decided to elevate the G20 meeting to a heads of state meeting. So it gained more prestige in 2008. It was held in Pittsburgh, the first summit, and it was a way to move beyond the G7 to include the BRICS countries plus some others to help set the economic system, I guess, the world trade system, the world economic system, back into a stable mode. So it looked at currencies, it looked at various stabilization measures. And from there, it started meeting in the first few years. It actually met twice a year and then once a year. But with the 20 members that are the G20 members, of which 19 are countries, and two are supranational organizations, the European Union. And as of 2023, the African Union has a seat at the G20. And they meet to So as the mission expanded, so did the agenda. So there are a whole manner of different issues that are being talked about. For example, South Africa has four priorities for its presidency. One, strengthening disaster resilience. Two, debt sustainability. Three, mobilizing finance for a just energy transition. And four, harnessing Africa's critical minerals. They talk about tax. They talk about currencies. They talk about a whole lot of issues that are, one might call it mission creep from the original design. But what's also happened over the years is that the G20 has spawned children and has created various engagement groups. The most prominent, probably the two that are most well known, are the B20, the Business 20, where leaders from those countries get together regularly. And the T20, the Think Tanks 20, or the Think 20. I remember being dispatched by SIAE to a meeting in Turkey, in Antalya. I think it was in 20, about 10 years ago, I think 2015, maybe slightly wrong on the year. But that's been going for a long time. And that is a kind of supplementary meeting or process of think tanks, research institutes that come up with bright ideas and try and feed them into the main G20 processes. We actually just concluded the South African T20 process on Thursday and Friday last week, and I was in attendance. So very, very interesting discussions held there. I think that's probably enough as an opening gambit.
Yeah, no, it is. Thank you, Stephen. But let me pose a question, and because you raised something in the midst of that concise explanation. Well, not concise, but thorough and thorough, comprehensive, and disciplined description. I think that's probably fair to say. Mission creep, and that means, I mean, that has a meaning which is awkward in international relations terms. I mean, a country sets out with one goal. And then eventually other things take over, and you end up doing things you hadn't expected to do or shouldn't have done. And there you are now, you're deeply enmeshed in yet something unrelated. My concern always has been there are lots of international economic and financial institutions on the planet already. Try as I may, I have been unable to determine nice, neat divisions of labor between the various institutions. I mean, there are obviously, the three Dumbarton Oaks institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and what started out as GATT, but which is now known as the World Trade Organization, they have purposes and they have raison d'être that seem startlingly overlapping to what the G20 is or purports to be. And those organizations actually have executive power to do things as opposed to the G20, which has the power to talk about things.
Indeed. Look, I think you're right. There are in these well-established, more formal institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, and the World Trade Organization. I think, though, they have become increasingly sclerotic over the years, also riven by geopolitics, certainly in the last 10 or 12 years. You know, why didn't Obama then call a summit of, or, you know, go through the United Nations? It was clearly a feeling that if you get the 20 most consequential economies together, they can hammer out something which can then be fed into the World Bank or the IMF to try and influence them. To a kind of, I think the idea was that the G20 would be a rapid task force that would bypass some of that bureaucracy. Of course, it creates bureaucracy of its own, but it's a strange animal. It's not a formal grouping, so it doesn't have a permanent secretariat. It doesn't even have a permanent website. So what we've been finding over the last few years is that each country reinvents the website and then says, oh, what, can we find the declaration from 2010? And what about this document? And what about that document? So there's not even a formal central repository. There's a lot of power and influence given to the particular host of that G20. And South Africa's presidency, for example, started on the 1st of December last year and will end on the 1st of December this year. And with all these other meetings that I mentioned, the G20, the B20, the T20, but there's also a Women's 20. This year, there's an Oceans 20. There's a Civil 20, an organization, a 20 for parliaments, et cetera, et cetera. So there are hundreds of meetings. And indeed, there is a lot of talking. There's a lot of hot air that's expended. And in fact, there's an article on our website, the SIA website, that talks a little bit about the Youth 20. And something which maybe isn't shocking, but is quite damning, in that the Youth 20 has been meeting for about 15 years, very fractious and lively, as one would expect a gathering of youth from those 20 countries to be. But they've made recommendations and they've made suggestions. Let me ask you, Brooks, how many of those suggestions over a 20-year period, a 15-year period, of which I think there were roughly 200, how many of them do you think made it into the final communiques from these various summits?
I'm going to guess somewhere between zero and five.
Okay, you're on the high side.
Naturally, we're going to have to take a station break for just a minute, and we'll be right back to just continue this discussion on the G20 and all of its many children. You mentioned Ocean's 20, and I resisted the urge to interrupt you and say, "Oh, it's a new film to follow in the Ocean's 11."
Could be, could be.
But I didn't say it, but now I have.
Now
Anyway,
you've
this
said
is
it.
a great time. We'll be right back after these messages. This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, Stephen Grews, who knows everything there is to know about the G20 and then some. And we'll be right back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, Stephen Grews of the South African Institute of International Affairs. And he has been closely following the lead up to the preparations for the G20 and all of its many children at this point, which we were just talking about. And you mentioned the Y20, not WHY, but capital Y for youth, and dozens of recommendations to the mothership. And the answer that you indicated is that none of its recommendations have worked their way into the final declaration. But that leads us to the inevitable question of a final declaration. Well, two questions, really. One, A, what's a final declaration for if it has no whip hand? But B, given the fact that the U.S. will not be present owing to its snit fight with South Africa, and that Russia will be represented by a distinctly lower level a parachique, and that the Chinese premier as opposed to president will be there, and at least two countries have indicated beyond those that they're not coming. Is there even any point in having final declaration if they should succeed in creating one?
So just let me dial back to a question that you asked and I didn't answer. Why is South Africa hosting it? Well, South Africa is hosting it because it is the last country on the roster that hasn't hosted it yet. A lot has been made of the fact that there are four developing countries in a row that have hosted. So Indonesia 2022, India 2023, Brazil 2024, and South Africa 2025. So issues that are important to the global south, like trade and investment, the climate, critical minerals, disaster resilience, these issues have been on the table. Digital public infrastructure was one of the things that India pushed. Ending global hunger was something that Brazil pushed. So it's part of that suite of countries, that group of countries, and a lot has been made of it. So it's also meant to be handing over to the US next year. And as you've said, Trump has, at first he wasn't coming and we were going to get J.D. Vance, the vice president. Then Trump said, no, 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 we're not sending anybody at all. Then Xi Jinping from China said that they weren't going to send anybody. Russia, Putin doesn't travel much because of the ICC warrant against him. And you're right, Argentina under Javier Milei and Mexico under Claudia Sheinbaum are both not. Those two leaders are both not coming. They will send lower officials. Is it worth getting a consensus document? Well, the latest that I read is that it's going to be impossible to get a communique out of this. And so then there's a fallback position, which is called chair's notes or Chair's Commentary. It's got various different names, but this was a kind of lower level summary. A chair's summary is what it's most often called. It's a lower level document in terms that it has even less force because it doesn't have consensus. And you know what? My colleague Elizabeth, who heads our institute, has been very, very involved. And she said in the negotiations on that wording, not only have the Americans, when they've attended, been very obstructionist, but the Argentinians as well have been, to use a American football analogy, running interference. They've been questioning the use of things that we thought were taken for granted in international parlance, like sustainable development goals, or sovereign equality, or gender. All these issues that have been so prominent as part of the discussions over so many years are now being undermined and questioned. You know, South Africa's theme for this year's G20 is solidarity, equality, and sustainability. All three of those are toxic in contemporary Washington.
Hold your thought there for a second. And the reason, as I understand it, the reason why those three terms in particular stick in the throat of Donald Trump and his crew is that they are in effect mimicking the very things that he opposes in domestic political parlance. And obviously, there's no point in supporting them internationally if you're already prepared to crush them domestically.
Bingo. I mean, these are, Rubio said this earlier in the year when he didn't come to the foreign ministers meeting, that this is just going against everything the current US administration believes in. So yes, you know, domestic policy often meets foreign policy. And this is one example where Trump has been going after diversity, equality, inclusion. This is writ large in South Africa's theme for the year. So in a way, it's very disappointing. It does spoil the party to some extent. It may be the first G20 summit that does not get a declaration. And it's looking increasingly likely that that's going to be the case, which is a shame for South Africa, which I think has put a lot of energy and effort into this. Joburg is apparently having a makeover, although I haven't seen too much evidence of that in my area. But what I do see is streetlights working, but of course, working during the day. And we're also seeing this will be a little bit like the press going after Olympic host cities. I think they have already had a go at Joburg and will continue to do so. You know, mentioning areas like Hillbrow and the many areas of the Central Business District, which are no-go areas, which are very dangerous, crime-ridden, filthy. Etc. That's not where the delegates are going to be going. They'll probably be going from their hotels in Sandton or Rosebank down the M1 to Nazareth. So a little bit, maybe we'll have some Potemkin villages on the side of the highway. We're already seeing floral displays and, as I said, working streetlights, but not. I'm not sure if they work at night, but they do work during the day. So it's a shame, I think. Maybe this is also part of Trump's intention to spoil the party, because of course there's been a souring of already fragile and brittle bilateral relations between Washington and Pretoria, if I'm allowed to mix my metaphors. That
Go right ahead.
relationship,
Throw them into the stew pot.
their relationship has taken a serious knock in the last year, but not only in the last year, in the last few decades, the relationship has been fraying and difficult.
That leads me to another topic, or a related topic, actually. Why is the relationship in such a, I'm looking for the right metaphor here, I was going to say roiling sea, or rocky path, or litter-strewn highway, or whatever it is. I mean, every time I'm asked this question, and I get asked a lot, I always try to point out that the relationship between the U.S. and South Africa is not solely that between two sovereign governments. There are hundreds of American businesses invested here with hundreds of thousands of employees, and many more indirectly dependent. There are scores and scores of NGOs that work across the border on all kinds of projects. There are exchanges of citizens and students and professors and what have you. And there are an infinite variety of people coming between the two countries looking for one thing or another as tourists or visitors, and sometimes immigrants as well. And so to look at the two countries only in terms of their government-to-government squabbles is wrong-headed, and there needs to be a bigger picture. And yet, the government relationship does set something of an agenda and a tenor for this larger picture. Where is the fundamental breakdown? There are irritants, lots of them, but what's the core question between the
Yeah, I
two
mean,
countries?
I absolutely agree with you. When I was at university and we were learning international relations, there was a lot of emphasis on states and state-to-state relations. But absolutely, all the other ties that you mentioned, academic, sporting, tourism, etc., etc. Look, it's difficult to go back and find one cause. I mean, I think one thing is again in that confluence of domestic and foreign policy. Trump's base is mostly blue collar white workers in the States. His MAGA crowd, his Make America Great Again crowd, and they see, as well as the evangelical Christians, they see South Africa today as a place where there is discrimination against white people, that there are attacks on white farmers, and that there's a white genocide going ahead. South Africa completely rejects that characterization, and I think rightly so. Is there crime in South Africa? Yes. Do white farmers get killed? Yes. Is there a genocide? No. Is there workplace discrimination? I guess there is. There's always the issue of black economic empowerment and affirmative action, and it's not always a legal play, a level playing field. So, were I to apply for a certain job, I have to factor in that they may have good black candidates that might get the job before me. There are those difficulties, but is it a genocide? Definitely not. It's nonsense. So, I think that's irritated. And that was the subject of Ramaphosa's visit to the White House. When was it? May, I think. Trying to stave off the tariffs, trying to stave off the expiration of the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which gave duty-free and quota-free entry for African products into the U.S. market. So that standoff has really irritated. I think added to that, their different views on Israel. Pretoria has long been a strong supporter of the Palestinians and very hostile to Israel. Of course, the US has been a staunch ally of Israel for many decades. Might be changing after this war a little bit, depending also on how strongly the Democrats fare in the midterms. But for now, the US stands firmly behind Israel. And South Africa took Israel to the International Court of Justice on charges of genocide. I think that's been an irritant and a difficulty in the relationship. And the US has pressured South Africa to drop that case. And South Africa has absolutely defied that. Whether these are causes or symptoms, I don't think it helps that neither country has an ambassador resident in the other country's capital. We know that Ibrahim Rasool got thrown out of the US as a persona non grata for some disparaging remarks that he made about Trump as a white supremacist. We have a American ambassador designate who's, I think, at the moment going through his Senate confirmation, Brent Bozell III, a big Trump supporter that I'm not sure how he's going to play. But we don't have a South African ambassador to the US. The special envoy that Ramaphosa appointed, Tembisi Jonas, by all accounts, has not been able to get a visa to the US. So those are some of the causes and symptoms. I mean, not least, the final one that I'd like to mention is really South Africa doesn't miss an opportunity to poke the big brother in the eye. And this controversy over the renaming of Sandton Drive, which is a street that runs between Sandton City and the US consulate. There's been a proposal for the last 10 years or so to change that from Sandton Drive into Leila Khaled Drive. And Leila Khaled is a famous Palestinian hijacker who hijacked not one but two airplanes and was responsible
Stephen, I'm going to
for.
have to, if I don't break right this second, hang on to that thought. This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, Stephen Hrust of Messiah, Jan Smuts House, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, as usual, and Stephen Hrust, a guest today from SIA, the South African Institute of International Affairs. And I interrupted him just before he was going to explain the denouement on Santon stroke Lila Khalid Drive as an irritant. But before he even does that, let me add one other irritant to your roster, which is South Africa's apparently close ties to Iran and to Russia to make it even more complicated, as well as its continuing usage of revolutionary rhetoric and language in the way it describes circumstances internationally, those as well. But finish up with the apotheosis of Lila Khalid, if you wish.
So this is happening in the city of Johannesburg. It was raised not by the ANC initially, but by one of the smaller parties, a Muslim party called Al Jamaa. It was supported by the economic freedom fighters. Anyway, why do they want to change the name of the road? Well, one of the reasons, and we've heard Nomvula Mokonyane, the deputy secretary general of the ANC, say we want the US to change their letterhead and to have to put Leila Khaled Drive on their letterhead for their consulate. The US has said if this does go through, they'll just close the consulate, and that will just be yet another further deterioration. Brooks, yes, you're right. South Africa's closeness to Iran, its closeness to Hamas, its closeness to Russia and to China are all sending up hostile signals to the US. So I think that is also in the background or in the foreground. South Africa is, you know, a very proud nation that wants to pursue an independent foreign policy that is non-aligned, and the US is trying to push it into a corner, and South Africa is resisting it. And you're absolutely right about the rhetoric. You know, the ANC has conferences every 5 years. If you read their international relations documents, you would think that we are still in 1963. Or somewhere about there, you know, with the balance of forces and Cold War rhetoric and so on and so forth. Don't also forget that the ANC was designated as a terrorist organization by the US, and that even caused trouble for Mandela when he was trying to make his first trip to the US after his release. So those things also stick in the craw.
Along the way with Lila Khalid Drive, would be Lila Khalid Drive. I suggested to somebody they simply just change the orientation of the consulate because it fronts on not only Santon Drive, but also Oxford Road, Rivonia Road, and just call it whatever number is appropriate on Rivonia Road and be done with the thing and just, you know, put a new entrance. And, you know, if we're playing, you know, one-upmanship, that's one way to deal with it. Closing the consulate would have all manner of repercussions on business relations, tourism, travel generally, the whole retinue of things that go on in state to state, in citizen to citizen activities. And now you mentioned the absence of ambassadors respectively, and that's obviously something which is extraordinary for two nations that presume to have a non-belligerent relationship. But I think back to a previous South African ambassador, a man who just passed away, actually, Franklin Son, who was South Africa's first other than white ambassador in the United States ever. And he came to the U.S., I think it was 1995, 90, late 94, early 90. He'd had a close but not deeply embedded relationship with the ANC. More of a business and education-oriented individual. But I remember him in Washington. We got to know him there as someone who did good work in building ties with American institutions and individuals, obviously riding on the fact that the president was Nelson Mandela. That didn't hurt matters. But He was not doctrinaire. He was not an ideologue. And he was, by most accounts, easy to get along with. And, you know, wasn't prickly, as some people can be, as perhaps Brent Bozell may be when he arrives here. Do you have any thoughts about the way the relationship originally evolved?
Yeah, I think you're right. And it surprises me that we cannot find, we don't seem to be able to find an acceptable person who can represent the country well without making the relationship worse. And yeah, so I don't know. The Jonas debacle is not helping. Yes, there have been times when relations have been much more cordial, and probably the U.S. president that's done the most for Africa would have to be George W. Bush, and we're looking there at the early 2000s when AGOA was first launched, when PEPFAR, well, that I think was a Clinton era. Policy on AIDS
during the Bush administration, actually.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, he visited Africa, which is something Biden only did very fleetingly, and Trump, I think, shows no interest in doing so. So, yes, there have been better times that one can look back to, try and build on, but it's broke. We've got to fix it.
Stephen, we have to take another break, station identification. And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, my guest, Stephen Cruz, and we're talking international relations, the G20, South Africa, U.S. ties, and more. And we'll be right back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back. This is The Deep Dive, and I am Brooke Spector, your host. And my guest today, I'm pleased to have Stephen Cruz, South African Institute of International Affairs, the man who knows everything there is to know about the G20 and pretty much everything else. I always like to have Stephen as a conversationalist in this program because he brings both an analytical talent as well as a diversity and a deep well of information and knowledge. And we have been going through the G20 and what it is and what it is not, more importantly, and perhaps expectations have been raised a little too high in South Africa that this is something that's going to produce something opposed to a meeting in which many things will be talked about and which some world leaders have elected not to come, either personal reasons or reasons of state or reasons of personal pique in the case of one man, as well as the fact that it's part of a larger sequence of events which do not necessarily produce outcomes and which exist in a sea of other acronyms, many of which are also dedicated to some of the same kinds of projects, ideas, and discussions. And there's a whole roster of them. And my favorite, of course, has always been APEC, the Asian-Pacific Economic Cooperation. And it searched in vain for years for a noun to end its title. And they finally ended up with the word forum, didn't even capitalize it, because it was also clear that it didn't provide for an executive outcome of events or decisions or processes, but it was a discussion club. Big countries, important issues, but not determinative. And G20, I guess, now bodes the same thing. Then we shifted slightly to the South African-U.S. Relationship, as torn and tattered as it is, even though at its heart, I would bet most Americans still feel reasonably favorably inclined towards South Africa. And if you were to poll South Africans, most of them feel reasonably kindly disposed to the U.S., partly as a function of the vast impact of business, commercial ties, and importantly, the soft power aspects, the cultural impact. It's hard to turn on a television station without seeing some version of the American presence. Go to a movie theater, a cinema, same thing is true. Read a book in a bookstore or a magazine and you see the impact as well. But nevertheless, it's quite clear, as Stephen has pointed out, there's much to repair. And at least at this point, little inclination to go ahead with that process. And if the street the U.S. consulate in Johannesburg is on becomes Lilac-Alee Drive, that's going to add yet more irritations to the problem. Let me slide the discussion slightly to a topic which, well, not slightly, I hard right turn. The recent arrival of an airplane in South Africa with 147 or 149 individuals, presumably from Gaza, a plane for which there does not appear to have been a clear process of departure, let alone clearance for landing, let alone visas for the individuals arriving, or a clear process for refugee status applications, or even who is going to support and who is going to take care of these individuals and how they got on the plane. And I'm still waiting for a much clearer explanation of all this than anything I've seen so far. What's your take on this?
Well, I don't think I'm going to provide it, unfortunately. I think we're in the fog of war still on this story. Yeah, it's astounding. I mean, you know, things were made worse by the Gift of the Givers director, Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman. I think poured some fuel on the fire here, rushing over to the airport, getting on the plane with the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Ronald Lamola, in tow, forcing these folks to be registered through the Department of Home Affairs, claiming this was ethnic cleansing and claiming that Israel had deliberately not stamped their passports. Well, for the last 12 or 13 years, Israel has not stamped anyone's passport because sometimes having an Israeli stamp in your passport could cause trouble for you going into a different country. So they've issued these little slips that are about the size of a business card that says you have successfully left or entered Israel. So it wasn't that these 150 people didn't have their passport stamped. Nobody has their passport stamped. It's murky, Brooks. It's fishy. It seems like it was haphazard, that the correct permissions were not acquired. I think it's become part of a political football match. You know, it's an opportunity to paint Israel in a bad light. And on the other hand, it seems like it was a mercy flight for people with dual nationality or who had serious medical conditions. Israel, I don't think, would have let the airplane leave if it wasn't satisfied that this was a legitimate trip. Then Suleiman also said this is part of Israel's quote unquote ethnic cleansing of the Gaza Strip. So I also have not seen satisfactory explanations of why and how this could happen. I believe they've come in on 90-day tourist visas.
Yeah, well, that would have been the fallback as opposed to admitted as protected individuals under rules of asylum. But I've done a little bit of international traveling in my life, and certainly since the early 1970s, the way in which a plane is cleared to depart from an airport has become infinitely more strictly organized than it used to be. You don't just take a giant passenger jet and fly it away. Destination's not entirely clear. A bunch of people on the plane, none of whom are properly cleared in the appropriate manner, and then land them somewhere without having filed the flight plan and the manifest matching up with all the people in the plane and so forth and so forth. And yet here we are with these people arriving.
And I don't think it was pleasant for the people on the plane either, because they were grounded on the tarmac for 11, 12 hours, probably without much food and water. And if indeed these are individuals who are ill, in need of medical attention, that's not great either. So I think it's also complicated by the fact that one of the ministers in our coalition government is the Minister of Home Affairs, Schreiber, who is from the Democratic Alliance, not the African National Congress. And that also may be adding to the confusion and the friction and the blaming and the finger pointing.
We're going to take a quick ad break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. My guest, Stephen Hruist, South African Institute of International Affairs. We've covered G20. We've covered U.S.-South African relations. We're now trying to understand the mysteries of the air flight that arrived almost out of the blue with 150 or so people from Gaza and the repercussions this is having to South African domestic political circumstances. And we'll be right back after these messages, then we'll wrap up.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, Stephen Hruist with South African Institute of International Affairs. And we're finishing up our discussion for this morning. We're looking at this extraordinary flight. The one question I want to pose to somebody, I know you don't have the answer, but I wish somebody would come up with it. How in the world was this plane chartered? By whom? And who paid for it? Let alone the fuel and the crew, because most charter airlines don't like to have their airplanes fly into a contested circumstance with the possibility the plane will be held until things are clarified.
Brooks, I think this may be the biggest aerial mystery since the disappearance of MH370. There's so many questions being asked about it.
If you read the social media chatter, inevitably what has popped up that this was a fiendishly clever plot by a really fiendishly clever group within Mossad, not even just the organization as a whole, to embarrass everybody and at the same time expel somehow a group of people, most of whom, as you say, appear to be rather innocent bystanders in all of this.
And I've also heard that this may be, a conspiracy theory that this is Trump, again, trying to spoil the G20 party to circle back to where we started, that this was deliberately sent to embarrass the South African authorities and show incompetence and inability to process foreign visitors in what is South Africa's biggest week on the international stage since the World Cup, the FIFA World Cup in 2010.
When we finally get to the bottom of it, if we ever do, we'll discover it was organized by yet some other group nobody's ever heard of, and the plane was chartered from a company that was in deep financial dire straits and needed some form of cash. Somebody showed up with a bag of money, and look, I mean, in my early career, I actually ran onto a tarmac to stop an airplane from departing until my guest, who was physically disabled and was hobbling down the gateway on crutches to get to the airplane. You can't do that kind of thing anymore.
Yeah.
It's only in the movies.
As Alice in Wonderland would have said, curiouser and curiouser, this one.
Yeah, which pill did you take, the red one or the blue one, kind of thing?
Yeah.
Stephen, this is always a joy to speak with you because you bring incisiveness and clarity to intrinsically muddy things.
Not to mention humor, Brooks.
Yes, humor. Humor goes into this. You know, I'm waiting for the drum roll. Maybe Vusi can find a drum roll to go with this. You know, a little bada boom, bada boom, bada bum. But again,
it's also nice to have the luxury of talking longer. Maybe I spoke too long, but when you're trained to give something in a 2-minute soundbite or a 30-second soundbite, it is nice to have this format where you can expand and converse, which is great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's the whole point. We dive deeply through conversation into a topic and hopefully just enough to whet listeners' appetites, make them come back for more. This is The Deep Dive, and this program is broadcast on Friday mornings at 9 and then repeated again on Sunday at 10. And then, of course, it's podcast so that everybody in the world can listen in. And if you like it, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell your relatives to dial it up on Sunday morning or to follow on the podcast, The Deep Dive. This is your host, Brooke Spector, saying goodbye and have a pleasant, warm, comfortable weekend, even if the traffic in Johannesburg, because of the G20, promises to be the most extraordinary, chaotic confusion that mankind can ingeniously create. But nevertheless, we'll be back again next week with another installment of The Deep Dive. You have a good weekend.